Good morning. I'm Denise Leslie. I'm pastor here at Memorial United Methodist Church. A junior class Sunday school teacher went to her happy, rambunctious 10 or 11 8-year-olds and said, "Would you like to give $1 million to the needy?" And they said, "Oh, yes. Yes, we'd like to do that. Would you like to give $1,000 to the needy?" "Oh, yes, we would do that." "Would you give $100 to the needy?" "Oh, yes," they said, "we would do that." "Would you give $50 to the needy?" "Yes, yes, teacher, we would do that." "Would you give $1 to the needy?" "Yes, yes," said all of the children except one little boy who was clutching his pocket. And the teacher looked at Johnny and said, "Well, Johnny, how come you didn't say yes this time?" And he stammered, "Well, I have a dollar." When we talk about money, it can be very offensive, right? We don't like other people telling us what to do with our money. And in fact, when we start talking about money and telling other people or hearing from other people about how to use our money, then we start feeling guilty and covetous and rebellious and all at the same time. But the Bible talks a lot about money. And Jesus talks a lot about money. And today we hear him talk about money. He talks about money in a story that makes us very, very uncomfortable. It's a very familiar story for people who have grown up in the church. And I'm here to tell you today that as a consequence of that prior conditioning around this story, it makes us uncomfortable for the wrong reasons. Let's take a look, beginning with verse 41. "He sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which were worth a penny." Now that makes me pretty steamed up. I don't know about you, but here's this poor lady, and she doesn't have anything, and you know, she gives so sacrificially. And here are all these other guys putting in out of their abundance. You know, it's not all they have to live on like she's putting in. She puts in her whole livelihood. The literal translation of all she had to live on is her whole life. Let that sink in for a minute. Her whole life. Pretty heavy. Well, at first glance, what does it look like? It looks like Jesus is commending the widow, right? For her sacrificial giving. Holding her up, extolling her as an example of what we should be doing as Christians. Singling her out, especially in contrast to the strutting peacocks who are, you know, marching along with their little retinue and making a big public show of putting their money into these big funnels that are in the temple for the purpose of depositing your offering and then offering long public prayers. Well, guess what? The reality is Jesus is not commending this woman. Mm-mm. He's lamenting. He's lamenting what he's seeing here. He's pointing out a tragedy. I mean, I want you to think about it. Do you think it would gladden God's heart to watch somebody become destitute? Does destitution gladden God's heart for any of God's children? No. No. If we accept the popular understanding of this story, then we completely miss something important about this passage, something that Jesus has to tell us. Let's see if we can begin to figure out what that is. First of all, if we accept the popular understanding of this story, then we put the widow on a pedestal, right? I'm down here, and she's up there. It's a lot of distance between me and her. When we put people on a pedestal, Well, we admire them. I mean, I admire Mother Teresa. I have always admired Mother Teresa. I always will. But you don't see me running off to the streets of Calcutta, let alone down on the streets of Fresno, right? Anybody here? I don't see it. When we put people on pedestals, we leave them there. We don't emulate them. We don't imagine ourselves alongside of them. They're too distant from our reality. We gush over them. We admire them. These awesome people. But they're doing something far beyond our capacity to achieve. We just don't see ourselves doing that kind of thing. And that's because people, the focus is on their giving and our inadequacy. And the result? Nothing changes. Nothing in our lives changes. And people, if Jesus is about anything, it's about changing lives. So if we're going to understand how that's going to happen through this gospel, we've got to see something about what Jesus was up against in his culture, what it was like, so we can unpack this a little bit and climb into it ourselves. Looking at verse 38, as Jesus taught, he said, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the best places, the best seats in the synagogues, and the places of honor at the banquets." So, who are these people in the long robes? What? I can't hear you. Rich people, yeah, but who else? No, they're not Pharisees. But that was a good guess. Huh? Us? Well, they could be us. But specifically, thank you, in this context, they are the scribes and the priests and the religious officials of Jesus' day. They're the religious elite. We know they're affluent because they put in their large gifts, right? But we also know something else that you and I wouldn't pick up on right away. We know because they're wearing long robes. Now, if you're wearing long robes, you're not out in the fields, are you? You're not in a carpenter shop or, you know, you're not doing any kind of hard labor. Nobody who did any kind of real work wore these long robes. They were a status symbol. They said, "I don't have to do that. I do something where I don't have to do that." Nor have any of these people stood in an unemployment line before. That's because their jobs come with family ties. They're kind of born to the manor, so to speak. Well, you probably wonder, how did that happen? Or why is that important? Originally, when Israel was wandering around in the wilderness, getting organized in the 12 tribes, and then moving into the promised land, they set aside one tribe to be the priestly tribe. And all the other tribes assessed themselves a tenth of all of their resources and what they had to support that tribe. And the purpose of that tribe is to help all the people follow the Ten Commandments, the law, right? Their dependency on everybody else served as a check and a balance that helped them maintain their role as servant people. Servant people to God, servant people to all the people. So their role was a very honorable one, and they literally lived out that scripture that says, "No one lives by bread alone, but by what? Every word that comes forth from the mouth of God." Okay, that's some of the background. But by Jesus' day, things have changed dramatically. Big change. Instead of a servant tribe, we now have a vast temple complex and a huge bureaucracy with a small army of religious officials who count themselves among the aristocracy of that society. Get the picture? And because there was no king or judge ruling over Israel at that time, because remember, Israel is ruled by who? Rome, that's right. Rome. So who are the people going to turn to? The religious officials become the de facto authorities in Israelite society. So Jesus' condemnation is not only for their public display, but for their hypocrisy and the way they have fallen away from the covenant, particularly that commandment that says, "Thou shalt not steal." thou shalt not covet. Jesus doesn't mince words here. He levels a charge. He charges them with downright exploitation. He says in verse 40, they devour widows' houses, and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. This is where our widow comes in. Enter poor widow. Perfect living example of what Jesus is talking about. As one Christian thinker put it, then Jesus says something like this. What it boils down to is, just in case you thought I was making stuff up on that point, check out this woman. She literally put in her last cent, all that she has, for the maintenance of this beautiful building. Now that poor widow, she's not a poor widow. She's poor because she is a widow. Because women in Jesus' day had no place without a man in their lives. You've heard me say that in other scripture passages that are similar in context. So if you didn't have a husband, and you didn't have a son, or you didn't have a grandson, or you didn't have some male relative, who did you have? You could go into prostitution, right? But you had no place. Or you had the possibility of one of these scribes, one of these religious officials, taking you under their wing. Taking you under their wing, reaching out to offer their protection to you. And then to divest you of whatever little property was left to you and line their own pockets. Awful, right? Huh. This widow, Jesus says, has been defrauded by wolves in sheep's clothing, mouthing pious platitudes, and basically brainwashed by these same people to give, that to give sacrificially like this is what God desires of them, is God's will for them. So much for caring for widows and orphans. Well, that is certainly a horse of a different color from the way I understood this story growing up. It'd be so much easier for me to get up here, make you all feel guilty about the widow, and, you know, let us all self-righteously sit here and think about how we can badmouth the guys out there. You know, this is financial stewardship time, and this is a financial stewardship sermon, and a little snake oil sure salves a lot of guilt. A lot easier for me to preach. I could quote to you chapter and verse about TV evangelists, right? Or preachers who will tell you that God will keep you from adversity or give you riches to cover all your unpaid bills if you just tithed. Or if you gave sacrificially to the church. But frankly, people, that's magical thinking, and Jesus doesn't engage in that. That's not the Jesus we know. That's not the God we know. And besides, TV evangelists, again, as examples of unscrupulous religious pastors, they're far away from us, right? Like that saint, Mother Teresa, far removed from us. We can feel good about denouncing them, but it makes no change in our lives. It makes no change in our lives. We need to get up close and personal. Jesus is saying two things we need to hear. First and foremost, don't be blind to the ways in which we benefit from systems which exploit the less fortunate. So easy for us to do that. I don't know about you, but just making it through the day and connecting all the dots in my day, dot to dot Denise. I don't have time always to understand all the complex issues of everything that comes along, but the fact of the matter is, ignorance is 9/10 of the law, right? And 9/10 of God's grace. We condemn ourselves by our choice to remain ignorant of reality, and we have countless examples. I'm sure I'll name a few, and you can think of a few. How about migrant labor here in the valley? They go out, they pick our crops, and we make them find a way into the country that is scary as all heck, right? They could lose their lives trying to get in. We throw up a wall, we pay them low wages. We make them work in the heat. Some people provide shade, others don't. Maybe there's a toilet nearby, maybe there's drinking water, maybe there's not. And politicians scapegoat them for being here illegally and make our farmers criminals for hiring them simply because we don't have the political will to deal with immigration, right? To change the system that will provide the farm labor that's needed in decent working conditions. Now, how about water? What about the West Side drying up? What about all those family farms that went out there in good faith to farm, and now all of their livelihood is blowing away in the dust? It's another complex issue. What about all of those permanent resident immigrants who are out there in places like Mendota, etc., where the community food bank is out there trying to keep people alive? Okay, now let's move in closer to home. Let's move in right here, right here. There are people in this congregation who give sacrificially to this, to our ministry here, and they live on Social Security. They give more than they can afford to give, just like this widow. And too often I hear words that just make me want to crawl under the bed when I go to the hospital and somebody, or to a residential care home, and some poor person is lying there in need of our care and our support and our love, and they say to me, "Pastor, I'm so ashamed, or I'm so embarrassed. I haven't been able to give my pledge. I haven't been home, or, you know, it slipped by the side." You know? I feel like a complete heel at that point. Every stewardship season, you hear me preach on tithing. I believe in tithing. But I also know that many widows' mites make my income possible, just as I also know that what I give, I can afford to give. It's not a sacrifice in the same way as it is for one of these people on this little fixed income. I mean, a person who makes $50,000 a year and gives 10%, they give $5,000, that leaves $45,000 left to live on, right? But somebody who lives on Social Security, let's say they make $12,000 a year, they give $1,200. How can anybody live on $10,800? How do you pay rent, pay health insurance, pay for medicine, pay for food? They're both tithers, but one is giving a whole lot more than the other. A whole lot more. So when I preach on tithing, I'm preaching to those of us who have enough and more than enough, who could give more than 10%. And not cut our food budget or our recreation interests or our kids going to the prom or, you know. But before we get trapped into making the exploited widow an example of faithful and sacrificial giving, let's move from feeling guilty and making no change to making a small change. Let's consider, what does it mean to make an offering? How can we do that? Well, people, I want to invite you for a moment to close your eyes. Now imagine those two small copper coins that the widow had. You are those two small copper coins. Imagine you placing yourself, those two coins, in the palm of God's hand. If they represent our whole lives as they did for the widow, then how can we give ourselves wholly to God, to God's way of living? How can we embody gratitude and generosity? We can do it by allowing God to take our lives and invest them. We can allow God to figure out how we need to be giving. We can change the focus from our giving to God's perspective of others receiving. You can open your eyes for a minute now. You know, gift giving is fun. We do it at Christmas. We look forward to it. We plan. We think about the people we're going to give to. We envision them. We go out and we buy with some purpose and some intention and some care. We're looking forward to delighting them, right? We're doing it out of love. We're doing it out of generosity. We're doing it out of that delight we're going to get when we watch them, when they open that gift. the hug we're going to get, right? Not that love is an unconditional, but we're doing it out of love. Gift-giving brings us joy and abundance. Like that little song you learned in Vacation Bible School, Love is Something If You Give It Away. Love is something if you give it away. Am I singing on key? Give it away, give it away. Love is something if you give it away, you end up having more. It's just like a magic penny. Lend it, spend it, and you won't have any. What's the rest of it? Hold it tight, and you won't have any. They'll roll all over the floor. That's what we want. And you'll end up having more. More love, more grace, more gratitude, more joy, more satisfaction. Not more money or rewards or brownie points. Just plain more happiness and contentment and a closer walk with Jesus. Walking the God life. When we have this kind of generosity and joyous spirit as a congregation, we are able to put all of our gifts together and accomplish amazing things. And you as a congregation have done that. Let me tick off a few things that you've done. You have supported a new Hmong congregation for the last 6 years. You have supported, made possible a community garden where Hmong elders have been able to maintain their self-respect, provide for their families with a skill that they have, and pass that on to their grandchildren and their children. You have helped two Katrina churches get back on their feet. You have provided this facility that's housing three different congregations, Korean, Hmong, Anglo, to worship in. Your donations of time and goods and talents has helped us to support a missionary in Macedonia. You have provided a mission thrift store that not only helps provide income for world service, but has helped families be burned out of their homes or people who need jobs get the clothes they need. You have done such things as help support, through your connectional giving, the first African university. Did you know that? But let's not pat ourselves on the back like the scribes running around in long robes while devouring widows' houses. Instead, let's take a moment to do something that will be in our pockets and be with us all the time as a reminder of God's love for us and God's presence in our lives. Take out some kind of money. I was going to bring a dollar up here. Pull out some coin or bill or something. Got something in your pocket? Now, what's it say on it? Besides having dead presidents on it, what's it say? In God we trust. Right. Not in the money that it's printed on, right? But in God's grace, God's forgiveness, God's guidance, God's presence in our lives. May we, our lives, be like this money that's in the palm of your hand, in the palm of God's hand. May we trust in it. It seems like a small thing to do to place our trust in God, but it makes a huge change. And it results in a lot of change for the whole world. Let the people say amen.